I wrong?
I would say that most contracts have a time is of the essence provision in them, or that a default is declared as soon as there is any default under the contract. You miss one payment, and the seller has the right to declare a default and foreclose it by whatever method is permitted under the contract terms.
Well, if it's after one payment, but do they say, but there's a 30-day grace period?
There's nothing in the statute right now that requires any grace period.
No, in terms of what the practice is.
And the typical contracts, Stevens Nest forms have forms that have no notice, and others have 10 days or 20 days, both, I've seen. That's a typical legal form. And attorneys...
We bought a house under contract.
Yeah.
I would say typically...
I put in a grace form in ours.
I'd say typically, Mike, if you're buying a residence, there's usually a specified time. If you're just buying a piece of property, there usually is not.
Let me ask you about the effective date of this act, then. Can we really do this in Section 7? The way I read this, you're saying that it's going to apply to contracts already written, but there haven't been forfeitures.
If your question is whether it is constitutionally permissible to make this bill apply to
existing
contracts, I think that the answer to that is yes, because this bill affects the remedies that are available, and it would be similar to a change in a procedural format. It does require certain notice that is not presently required, but it is my opinion that this bill would be constitutionally enforceable. First of all, the court system is not involved in the forfeiture. And the courts have noted that distinction, that they are only involved afterwards in the status of the title. And so I don't think we have a due process concern here like we would in a judicial foreclosure or some other situation where there's the court system is involved.
What about for those contracts that may have a forfeiture provision in it, but they are not as high of a standard, if you will, as these presented here?
I would be happy to do further research on that question and submit additional testimony, because I think it's an important question. It's one that I had considered, and it was my feeling in looking at it that this is a remedy statute rather than a substantive statute, and therefore that the retroactivity would not be a problem. But I would be happy to do some further research and submit something.
Okay, Representative,
Mr. Chairman, just to comment on that regard, I agree with you that it may be constitutional. I happen to believe it's bad policy. It's my preference that we do this prospectively, that we say that only on contracts issued from the effective date of the act forward will we use this notice. Otherwise, to me, even if you can do it legally, it's sort of changing the rules in the middle of the game. So if I'm going to support the bill, I would want an amendment like that.
Stan, I would go one step further and say only on contracts where there is no specification.
Well, what would happen as a practical matter if you had this bill and made it effective on contracts from the date forward is that all contracts would have those terms.
If I may address that, it should be pointed out that this bill only applies if the contract does provide for a forfeiture remedy. And I don't know if... So in other words, if the contract has nothing about forfeiture remedies in it, this doesn't add anything.
See, if I might just comment further, you'd have the same thing that you have in the other remedies now. There are certain standard things in the other remedies, and all contracts are just aware of those standard remedies, and that's what would happen here.
Further questions or comments?
I think we've hit the highlights through your questions. The only one that I might point out specifically and draw your attention to again is Section 6, which refers to the filing of this affidavit. The affidavit is recorded in the deed records of the county in which the property is located, and the recitals in the affidavit are prima facie evidence in a court of the truth of the matter set forth therein. That language tracks the language of the trust deed statute, ORS 86780, relating to non-judicial trust deed foreclosure. So that, again, would just, it just puts of record what happened. And when it says it's prima facie evidence, that means that it could be shown to be untrue, but until shown untrue, it is considered true.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bellamy.
Now let's say you've gone through, this is designed to give the contract holder a process of forfeiture, so they can go through a process and get something forfeited. What happens at that point now? It's done, you forfeited. As far as the title is concerned, what do you do then?
Well, of course, then it's a problem for the seller, what the seller is going to do, and it's how persuasive the seller can be to the title insurer. It may be necessary. The title company may say, I'm not happy with this particular part of the transaction, and it may be necessary for them to file a suit to quiet title of the real property in any event. I don't know what the result is going to be. It's the expectation that that would not be a necessity in all cases.
I guess my question to you would be that we have gone through this process of giving the owner of the contract the right to forfeit, and we've given them a legal process by which they can go through to get something done. How come we didn't go the one step to give them authority to do something then?
Well, they can. And first of all, let me say that this doesn't give anybody a right that they didn't already have. Because
I understand that.
Okay. They either have the right already under the contract or they don't. It merely specifies how the remedy is going to be enforced. But when the remedy is completed, when the process is completed, arguably the seller has title to the property, and the seller could turn around and convey the property to someone else.
I guess my concern comes as this. If I was trying to peddle a piece of property that I had to forfeit, I have to go convince the title insurance company that I had the right to forfeit, and they forfeited, and all this stuff was done, and they don't like that, so they don't do it. And you got a nervous buyer. The nervous buyer says, wait a minute, I'm not going to buy something if I don't have the title. So now we give this process. I'm not so sure we've done anything, because the title company's sitting there saying, okay, yes, you tried to notify, and yes, you gave them 60 days and so forth. And if I was a nervous buyer, I guess I wouldn't be any more assured of buying this piece of property from you than in the old process where there wasn't something set, because you gave me a process, but at the end of the process you didn't give me something to do that would convince the title company that you had the right to sell the property again. You in essence had the deed. I guess I'm saying that you've given us a process, but I'm not so sure it's the title company's would be any more happy with it. And maybe Stan can comment.
Well, I don't think the title companies are going to buy it, but what I think you do have, once you've cleaned up the process and the notices, if the buyer has taken off, the quiet title action can be, by default, can be a fairly swift and prompt thing. And as a practical matter, you may want to choose one of the other remedies, but this at least gives you an alternative that if we pass this bill, if we want to, cleans up the notices so that everybody knows the rules of the game better. I think that's fair.
I think it should be pointed out, too, that the bill does provide additional protections to buyers that are not presently under the law. Not only to buyers, but to subordinate lien holders, like somebody that does work on the property and has filed a lien, or a lender who has loaned money on the equity that the person has in the house, that this bill does provide additional safeguards for those categories of people in that it permits notice and an opportunity to cure in all cases, as opposed to the limited number of cases and the limited periods of time that are presently found under the case law.
Okay. You need to go a little further in that one for me.
Okay.
I have a land sales contract with you. You come in and bought a piece of property. I don't know how you would ever do it, but you're telling me that you went and got a mortgage from a banking institution to build a piece of property, or build a housing plan, without getting a first mortgage. I don't know how you could ever do that. And you're telling me that if you got that done, that this process would help that banker?
Well, first of all, I agree with you that probably, and under the present state of the law, after the recent decision by the Supreme Court that I mentioned earlier, that State of Brewer case, there aren't very many lending institutions that are going to lend money in these circumstances. And
yeah.
And I expect to see something in the legislature here in an attempt to overturn that decision and to permit a contract vendee to have the same rights with respect to his or her property that a mortgagor has, you know, to put a second mortgage in effect on the property. But there are numerous places where you'll see an assignment of the vendee's interest for security purposes, to secure a loan between related parties or between, that's really the worst case. What if somebody's father loans them money? And then, or as in the case that just came down, a State of Brewer versus Iota Delta chapter, a national fraternity lent money to a local chapter on the vendee, with the vendee's interest as security, and were ultimately foreclosed because the local chapter abandoned its interest in the contract. Now, just turning that around, if they'd been forfeited under the present state of the law, I don't believe that there's any protection for that subordinate lien holder. There's no notice that's required. Even if the seller knows about the person, they're not required to give them notice or the opportunity to cure the default.
I guess I don't see where you've helped them.
Well,
you tell me you've helped the subordinate lien holders.
Okay, now the subordinate lien holders can come in and say, all right, if my assignor, if the person from whom I've gotten my interest doesn't want to cure because they say, forget it, I'm so far underwater, I'll never get out, then they can come in and say, yes, I think there's equity in the property, I'll pay off the underlying obligation that's in default to protect my own interest, and then I'll foreclose my lien on the property, whatever it is. So instead, it provides a mechanism for that person to save whatever interest they have in the property.
Further questions?
Well, I'll just wait.
Sure. You can always catch them after the hearing or on the telephone. I think we need to look at this individually.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I will submit additional authority with respect to the constitutional issue for your consideration, the Section 7.
Thank you very much for your time. Apologize again for the show. Representative Springer?
Just a quick one, Don. I assume you did talk and have probably had continuing conversations with the legal staff of the title companies in the state.
Yes.
Can we expect any amendments or any participation by them at some point in this process?
I do not expect that they will have any amendments, and I think that they will submit testimony supporting the bill, and I'll have to prod some people and find out. I think this, no one knew that the hearing was going to be today, and mm-hmm. so I believe that they have considered it and are going to give their support to the bill.
I for one would feel more comfortable knowing how those title
okay.
folks feel about it, and even though we may not be able to resolve all their problems and the subsequent, judgment or what have you, may be necessary to absolutely lay at rest any of the issues about whether or not they're going to issue a policy. I would, for one, would look forward to their review and input, if any, on this.
I will contact several of them and see if I can get them to submit something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming down today. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2531 and begin a hearing on House Bill 2205. I don't have it. I do have a sign-up sheet. I think Mr. Mass is here.
Which is all right. We're still... Oh, we got another bill. Oh, another bill. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I got the bill. Where are we? 2531?
2205.
2205.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the courts. The Judicial Department asked that House Bill 2205 be filed, and it basically is a bushel basket full of remedies to problems that we have seen developing over the years, and particularly in a year and a half since I've been in the court. What I'm going to do is basically just walk through the bill and point out to you what the nature of the change that we're asking for.
Thank you.
In section number one, under current law, the chief judge of the court presides whenever he is a member of the panel. The problem that this causes is that there are 10 members of the court. They sit in panels of three. The chief judge is not a regularly assigned member of any one panel, but he sits on individual panels where he is needed. When he sits as a substitute for a non-presiding judge, he would rather that the regularly presiding judge continue to sit as the presiding judge. And so we're offering the amendment to ORS 2.570 that would permit him to designate another judge to sit as the presiding judge even when the chief judge is a member of the panel. Subsection 2, we're asking for an amendment to the definition of trial court clerk in light of the fact that the county clerk no longer functions as the trial court clerk. We're also asking that the notice of appeal be defined to include a cross notice of appeal to make it clear that all the statutes governing notices of appeal are equally applicable to cross notices. Section number three relates to filing notices and other documents by mail. When this section was section was originally added, I believe in 1983, the intent of the drafters was to authorize the filing of notices of appeal, cross notices of appeal from both district and circuit court, petitions for review, and petitions for judicial review by mail, and that the filing date would be deemed to be the date of mailing if the document was filed by registered or certified mail with proof from the post office of the date of mailing. What happened in the drafting of it apparently is that the reference to petition for judicial review was left out. The result is that the statute as it's drafted is not literally applicable to those categories of cases. We would like to make it clear that it would be applicable to those category of cases subject to the proviso except as otherwise provided by law. We're not aware of any, but if there is some special statute that sets forth a particular method of filing a notice or petition with the court, those particular sections should govern rather than this general statute. The amendment also makes clear that if you file your notice or other document within the appropriate period of time, you will not need to furnish proof of filing with the court. We only need the proof of filing when we actually receive the notice outside the usual 30-day appeal period. Section 4 relates to the portion of the notice of appeal where the appellant designates the portion of the trial record that he or she wants the court to look at. Under existing law, once the notice is filed, the appellant must get leave of the court to amend the designation of record. In our experience, this is, generally speaking, a waste of time because the respondent never opposes the change designation of record, and we only need it in order to put the court reporters and the trial court clerks and our own clerical staff on notice of what the record is going to be. Therefore, we are asking for this for ORS 19029 to be amended so that a party could amend the designation of record anytime up until 35 days after the transcript is filed, simply by filing an amended notice of appeal or an amended designation of record. After that time, then the litigant would need leave of the court in order to get an amended designation of record. In Section 4, we're also asking to add a new requirement to the notice of appeal, and that is the signature of the appellant or the appellant's lawyer. This tracks with ORS 138.090 in criminal cases, which states that the appellant must sign the notice of appeal. But it also would be helpful to us because sometimes with pro se litigants, and even unfortunately sometimes with lawyers, we get multiple copies of documents and they differ from each other, and we're not sure which one they intended to be the notice of appeal that they want the court to act on. We would like to make clear that the court would not consider the absence of a signature to be a defect that would warrant throwing the case out. It's just something that we would like to have. Section 5 is probably the most important of all the sections of the bill. And with respect to ORS 0.033 subsection 2, under existing law, the failure to serve a notice of appeal on any party who appeared at trial is a jurisdictional defect which will result in the automatic dismissal of your case. And this is true even if the party who appeared in the case appeared by way of a stipulated order dismissing him from the case because he had no interest in it. It frequently happens in multi-party cases that you sue everybody you can think to name. And as the case goes on, you realize that certain of the parties that you name have no interest in the action. You have no interest in holding them liable, and so they are dismissed out from the case. Maybe 2 or 3 years down the road, you actually go to trial, and a verdict is entered against somebody. Losing party appeals that. If the losing party, if the appellant omits to serve one of these parties dismissed from the case early on under Jacobson versus Mountain Home Park Homeowners Association, we must dismiss that case. The duty to serve all parties to a case, all parties who appeared in a case, is a bright line for us. It's easy to minister because anybody who we were able to find out was a party at any one time, they're not served, appellant is out. But by the same token, that bright line highlights the hardship that is worked on litigants in complicated cases who, for one reason or another, are not able to keep track and or fail to serve a party who appeared. We are interested in developing a standard that would allow us not to dismiss cases in those cases where, for one reason or another, a party who appeared at trial was not served with a copy of the notice. The problem is, once you get by that standard of everybody's got to be served, where do you draw the line? the language in this bill talks in terms of if the notice of appeal identifies the adverse parties, that is the parties that you think are going to be the real parties in interest on appeal, then if you serve all of those people, you will not, your case will be within our court and you will not be subject to dismissal. But if you fail to identify adverse parties, then you must show proof of service on everybody who appeared in the action. And I want to draw to your attention a bill, Senate Bill 99, which is still pending the Senate Judiciary Committee. I testified on behalf of the Judicial Department at the hearing on that bill, and at that time we were advocating for a somewhat different standard, and the standard that we were advocating for at that time is proof of service on all parties identified as adverse parties, or if no adverse parties were identified, then the parties whose claims and rights were determined in the judgment on appeal. Upon reflection of our testimony in Senate Bill 99, it occurred to us that attempting to determine whether a particular judgment determined a particular party's rights or claims gets the court involved very deeply in the merits of a claim simply to find out whether the court has jurisdiction of the cause or not. It is our view that whether we have jurisdiction of a case should be something readily determined by a quick look at the papers filed. We do not believe that we should have to, as a regular matter, have to order up the trial court record, go through the trial court record to find out whether a particular party's claim or judgment was determined by a judgment that is on appeal now. We recognize that we are, by the standard that we're also advocating in House Bill 2205, to some extent puts us back in the same business, because we might have to at some point go back through the whole record to find out if some party made an appearance early on. But even if we have to do that, it is much simpler to determine whether a party made an appearance in a case than it is to determine which claims were alleged, which claims were withdrawn, dismissed out, whether somebody, whether a judgment that is ultimately entered determines that claim. For those reasons, we are at this time advocating for the standard set forth in House Bill 2205 rather than Senate Bill 99. There are amendments proposed at ORS 19.033-2B, and these amendments merely codify holdings to the effect that the failure to serve the notice of appeal on court clerks or court reporters is not a defect that will result in dismissal of the case. In Section 5 of the bill, there's a new subsection that we're offering, which would be known as ORS 19.033 Subsection 4. I like to call this the Making the Record Speak the Truth provision of our bill. Frequently, the court runs into the problem where there is a defect in the form of the judgment from which the appeal is taken. For instance, the court could have intended that a document called an order be the judgment of a case. The Supreme Court in City of Portland versus Carrigan says you can't do that. A judgment is a judgment and must be called a judgment or it isn't a judgment. That results in us dismissing as being an appeal taken from a non-appealable judgment where this document is called an order. And what frequently happens is the parties go back to the trial court, They have the identical document signed by the judge, and the only change is in the upper right-hand corner instead of saying order, it says judgment. We would like to have the authority, without dismissing the case, getting the jurisdiction back to the trial court, to simply authorize the trial court, that is, have the parties ask leave of our court to move the trial court to enter a judgment that will be an appealable judgment in terms of its form. In order to do that, the movement would have to satisfy us that the trial court probably intended to enter an appealable judgment. We don't want to get into the business of a party trying to pull a fast one on us and saying that the trial court really intended to enter final judgment when it is when it should be obvious on the record that the trial court did not intend to do that. So we want leave of our court. We want the party to satisfy us that the trial court intended to enter an appealable judgment, and that the failure of the trial court to do so was the result of a drafting error or another category of cases, or actually two different categories of cases, is where the trial court does not have jurisdiction of the cause of action because the case is presently pending on appeal. Those cases result because you get...